Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. Some of you will remember living through the 1970s, and I was thinking how soon we forget all of this. The price of gas goes down and we forget about what happened in the 1970s when we had a cutoff of oil from the Mideast. There were two major energy crises. And actually, as our guest says, most of the 70s we could consider as an oil crisis, an energy crisis. We were wearing cardigan sweaters. We were turning off our Christmas tree lights. We were waiting sometimes in lines that were a mile long for gas, and you'd be waiting for gas and you'd run out of gas while you were waiting for gas. There was a rationing of gas. It was a very difficult time. 40 years ago, Meg Jacobs begins her new book saying Americans were suffering from what contemporaries call the energy crisis, a crisis that in many ways defined the decade of the 1970s, the twin oil shocks of 73 and 79, oil supplies dropping, prices going way up. At the average citizen understood the energy crisis to mean a panic at the pump. And it was quite different than the filler up mentality that we had in the 1950s. There are a lot of aspects to this story, including a very interesting political aspect that Meg Jacobs outlines in her book, that it may have moved the country rightward, this crisis did. And we'll talk about why. We'll talk about the New Deal kind of mentality that we still had in the 1960s, and that's somewhat eroding, and then major eroding, partially as a result of the energy crisis. Meg Jacobs is our guest, and as I said, she is the author of Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis, and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s. She teaches history and public affairs at Princeton University. She is author of Pocketbook Politics, Economic Citizenship in 20th Century America, and co-author of Conservatives in Power, The Reagan Years, 1981 until 1989. Meg, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. You know, I'm reading about this, and I lived during this time, but I'm thinking as I'm reading your book, which is so well done, how soon we forget all of this. How soon we forget. We're driving 70 miles an hour. We're buying SUVs in great numbers. It's never going to happen again, huh?
That's certainly what most Americans think. As soon as gas prices go down, we resume our buying of large SUVs. We drive three times as many miles as we did during the 1970s energy crisis, and we forget and conveniently don't think about the possibility that supply will ever be an issue again.
Yeah. Let's pinpoint these 2 years that are so crucial in that decade, and one is from Middle East nations who wanted to retaliate for President Nixon's support of Israel against an attack on Egypt, and then what happened later in 1979. What happened in 73?
So in 1973, in response to American support of Israel in the Yom Kippur War, Arab members of OPEC institute an embargo against the United States, and they also reduce their production to shrink the global supply of oil, further creating a shortage in the United States. And that occurs in the fall of 1973, and the embargo lasts about 4 months. And as you say, it really sort of turns American life upside down. And the car, which had once been this symbol of American greatness and strength and superiority, now became a symbol of its decline as Americans had to wait on lines that stretched for a mile and sometimes longer. Mm.
And the first chapter of the book takes us prior to 1973, a very interesting chapter about George Herbert Walker Bush,
yes,
who was in the oil industry and in many ways got a lot of our oil to come from the Middle East, didn't he? He was instrumental in that.
Well, he's a really interesting character, and I begin and end the book with him because we begin with him graduating from Yale University in 1948, and he decides to move with his family to Texas in search of oil and the American dream. And he does so at this moment when there's a big discovery of oil in West Texas, and it's sort of this moment of abundance that Americans think will last forever, not unlike the current climate with fracking today. So we start the story there so that we can understand and appreciate the devastating impact of the 73 energy shock, which some saw as an energy Pearl Harbor. And then the story, as you say, ends in 1991 with George H.W. Bush in the White House when it's clear that America no longer can supply enough energy to meet its needs. And the result is we have to use military force to secure access to oil abroad.
And you write early in the book, which I find interesting, that the news of this first embargo, this first cutoff of oil in 73, was stunning to the American public because we didn't know that the country imported any oil at all, really?
Truly. That's not just because Americans don't follow the global oil market. It's also because this was a relatively new phenomenon. For much of the 20th century, we had been the leading producer of energy, and we were more than self-sufficient. But that changes rather abruptly. So between 1970 and 1973, the amount that we import doubles. 1970 was the moment when we appeared to be reaching our peak of geological production in this country, and so we supplement with imports. And this had come about very rapidly, so it's not altogether surprising that Americans didn't know that we imported oil. And then there's another element to it, too, which is even if we did import oil, much of the way that oil came to us was through the major oil companies, most of which were American. So the idea is that these large oil companies, you know, going back to John D. Rockefeller, were all powerful. So it was hard to imagine that Arab sheikhs could dictate and control the oil market.
Yeah, it's still hard to imagine, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, you know, we tend to believe that American companies, corporations are incredibly powerful, and in the energy industry, that's still a prevailing belief and assumption today.
Yeah. When you talk about this peak geological production, it was indeed that the reality, or was it equally a reality that we could get the oil from the Mideast because it was closer to the ground, we didn't have any unions, et cetera, over there, we could get it much more cheaply from the Middle East?
Well, it's true that it was cheaper to produce oil in the Middle East, but our allies in Europe and Japan were much more reliant on that oil than we were. And so our defense of the Middle East has been as much about sort of offering protection to our allies as it is to securing our own supply. But it certainly was true that the amount that we were producing was declining by 1970.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen just a little bit to Richard Nixon. This is when he famously talked about our becoming independent, energy independent, which is amazing to hear him say this. Well, amazing what happened to him shortly after this, too, when he had to resign the presidency. This is Christmas of 1973, and he was telling us then that, you know, we shouldn't be using the lights on the Christmas tree, which some people thought was a trivial way to beat the crisis here. But here is what President Nixon has to say. And Meg has very interesting thoughts in the book and research about where he was politically, what he had to do politically, how much he could act conservatively, how much he had to still deal with kind of a New Deal mentality. Here is the president addressing the nation in 1973.
This year, we will drive a little slower. This year, the thermostats will be a little lower. This year, every American perhaps will sacrifice a little, but no one will suffer. But we will do it for a great goal. The goal first of seeing to it that in a year when our energy supplies are not as high as we need, we can prepare for the future. And also a year in which America will make a great stride forward toward a new great goal. And that is, by the year 1980, this nation, which will celebrate its 200th anniversary of independence in 1976, by 1980 will celebrate Project Independence, when we are independent of any other country in the world where our energy supply is concerned. That we can do.
1980, huh, Meg?
That's an amazing clip. I'm glad you played it, because if I were just to simply say it out loud, the idea that we would be energy independent, self-sufficient by 1980 seems hard to imagine. And indeed, the project independence, as it was called throughout the 1970s, was a failure. So that by 1991, by the time of the Gulf War, we're importing more than 50% of our energy needs, up from about a third during when Richard Nixon makes that declaration.
Mm. And you make this interesting comment that, you know, then we have Watergate, we have, although the energy crisis is more important than Watergate, at least initially, have the resignation of Nixon, and you have this loss of faith. People lied to us in Watergate, they lied to us in Vietnam, but they didn't know what to do when it came to the energy crisis. And all of a sudden we get a political shift, right, away from a New Deal, government can help us mentality.
Well, what's amazing is Richard Nixon understood that he faced a Democratic Congress, and that the default, when people were suffering economically, when they were feeling the pinch in their pocketbooks, as a result of the energy shortage, when prices were soaring, that Democrats would want to, and Americans would expect them to offer some kind of relief. So he makes the speech that you just played for your listeners in an effort to kind of derail and slow down their momentum, because the number one demand, and it ultimately succeeds, is a call for rolling back the prices at the pump, which is impossible for us to imagine today. In the 1970s, the entire energy industry was under regulations by the American government, even to the point where we almost had mandatory rationing in this country. Again, something hard for us to believe. So Nixon is appealing to Americans to voluntarily conserve as a way to try to thwart this momentum. The momentum keeps going as the lines get longer, and as a result, you have all of these controls and allocation measures put in place. You have the first energy czar, William Simon, whom Nixon appoints, who decides things like, instead of the Daytona 500, this year will have to be the 450. So very sort of hands-on interventionist. And what you'll see by 1979, which is the second Doyle shock, precisely because government has tried so much to mitigate against the energy crisis, to offer relief at the pump, Jimmy Carter in particular, who's president in 1979, has promised to solve the energy crisis. Because there's this tremendous failure to do so, to prevent the return of the gas lines, the result is a loss of faith in government to solve basic problems.
Did we succeed at all? I remember those years, and I know people were driving smaller cars. The speed limit, which seems to make sense to me just for an accident point of view, 55 miles an hour. Now we're at 70 in the state of Wisconsin, which seems pretty high speed to me. Did we make, were we successful at lowering our demand just because of conservation?
Well, we did make some improvements. So it's in the 1970s, during the Ford administration, that we have the first imposition of CAFE standards to make our cars more efficient, for example. Carter is the sort of number one conservationist president, so it's under Carter that you have public policies put in place to encourage energy efficiency in appliances, for example, or weatherization of homes. And you do see a real gain in energy efficiency throughout as a result of these public policies, and also because energy prices are so high that industry realizes that it just doesn't make sense to, you know, not think twice about how they use their energy resources.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for Megan. We'll take them momentarily. Meg Jacobs is our guest. She's written a fascinating book that looks at the oil crisis in the 1970s, particularly the one that hit in 73 and another in 1979, and what it did to conservation efforts, what it did to people's belief that government could fix the problem or government was the problem. It kind of resulted in a change in political ascendancy, really, of the right in this country, partially as a result of this energy crisis. The other part of her book is, and the transformation of American politics in the 1970s. Here's our phone number. We'd love to hear from you. And isn't it amazing? Here we are, 70 miles per hour on the freeways here in Wisconsin. You go higher than that in some parts of this country. You walk out and you look at who's on the road, and it's tons of SUVs and vans, and we're in a whole different place now, even though we were going to be energy independent back in the 1970s, and conservation was more top of mind, and yet conservation maybe should be top of mind because of all of the other issues that are going on in the world, like it's warming up. Here's our phone number. We'd love to hear from you, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, where we love to read your comments, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Meg teaches history, public affairs at Princeton University. She is co-author of Conservatives in Power, The Reagan Years, 1981 to 1989, and she is author of Pocketbook Politics, Economic Citizenship in 20th Century America. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Meg Jacobs, our guest this hour, Panic at the Pump, the Energy Crisis, and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s is our topic, and we start our calls with Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. The best of shows, Kathleen. Yours are the best of shows.
Thanks.
I'm not making fun of the author or the times I lived through them, but seriously, folks, fellow Americans, I mean, we had to wear cardigans. We had to shut off our Christmas tree lights. We had to wait in lines. And we suddenly realized that energy could be expensive, which throughout the world was relatively well known, that energy could be much more expensive than it was in America. And poor Jimmy Carter. Here we have a college graduate, scientifically educated president, who basically says, we've got to really shift our attention on energy. He's defined as having a failed presidency, and then we elect a movie actor, a TV actor, not that he didn't have a college education, he did, but he wasn't a scientist. And I'm sorry, I just think the delusions of the American people are just mighty strange, and I'd like to know your author's take on Jimmy Carter in terms of actually being a bellwether for saying we really need to shift our focus on energy, folks.
Thanks, Rich. Meg?
That's a good question and a good comment, and Jimmy Carter does get sort of a bum rap, but in fact, as you suggest, he was quite courageous in putting out the idea that what Americans needed to do was actually cut back. And he takes office during the coldest winter, one of the coldest winters on record, where the entire East Coast, Eastern Seaboard, is in this deep freeze. And that's the context for him appearing in a cardigan sweater just days into his presidency, seated by the White House fire. And he says, this is permanent. Sacrifice is going to be a way of life. And if Nixon told you that you had to dial down to 68 degrees, I'm telling you that the new normal is going to be 65 degrees. And he tries to lay it out directly for Americans that they were using too much. And what's interesting about Jimmy Carter is he says this is not only an economic issue, this is not only a national security issue, but this is a moral issue. So in fact, he says that solving the energy crisis is a top priority for his administration, and he says it's the moral equivalent of war. And unfortunately, he soon derided, and the program is known as MEOW, the unfortunate acronym, and he doesn't get the kind of reception, positive reception from the public that he had been hoping for.
Mm-hmm. He put the solar panels on the White House. Did Reagan take those off, and are they gone now, Meg?
Yeah, so the context for Carter installing the 32 solar panels on the roof, which were visible from Pennsylvania Avenue, it's the summer of 1979. It's the peak of the gas lines, and Carter is desperate to sort of show some leadership on the issue. And so he dedicates these solar panels, and he says, you know, this is the way of the future, renewable energies. And he promises that by 2000, the United States will get 20% of its energy from solar and other renewables. And, of course, that doesn't come to pass. And Reagan, as you say, removes the solar panels, and it's a long time until there is any kind of national public discussion about the need for renewables like we're having today. Mm.
And tell me about the decision. It must have been more than this, or was it this, to let the Shah come into this country for medical treatment. Is that indeed what resulted in the Iranians cutting off oil?
Well, that's credited more specifically to the hostage crisis itself. So what happens is that you have the Iranian Revolution, and that destabilizes the global oil markets and leads to a reduction in Iranian oil production. And so then that's a shortage, which in turn leads to the return of the gas lines in the summer of 1979.
Hmm. Thanks.
And then
go ahead.
And in Wisconsin, actually, you have billboards that read "Fight Back, Drive 55," with a picture of the Ayatollah Khomeini on them, somehow linking our sort of appeal to conservation with the ability.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rich, very much for your call. Ruth is next in Altoona. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. You know, I appreciate this program, and by the way, we have the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair coming up.
Oh, great.
In Custer, Wisconsin, the weekend of June, I think it's the 16th, 17th, 18th, anyway, somewhere in there. But, you know, when you're looking at, you know, people are upset because of the cost. I've lived that time, too, and what I remember is people did it. You know, that people did it. They saw it as American. They saw it as patriotic. And people did it. And I don't, other than the long lines, there weren't a lot of hardships as such. People seemed to make it through. But, you know, now, I mean, when we look at the cost of our energy policies, we're talking about people sending their children off to war. We're talking about people, you know, dying on both sides. We're talking about the cost of war. So, you know, we really have to look at those costs as we evaluate our energy policy and our use of energy. And what really frustrates me in this day and time is the lack of conservation, the lack of a call for conservation, which would do so much in our country without even necessarily, again, creating any hardship.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not comparing that time to this time completely. I'm just saying there's so much people could do. And then, you know, you think about Fukushima and them having to change where they got their energy. You know, Japan didn't collapse. They got energy from other sources. They began to get renewables in place. So just that's a lot to put out there, but I feel like we have to factor in, it seems, the cost of war, both the human cost and the financial cost, in order to keep the level of mm-hmm. energy usage that we have, which is just extreme.
Yeah, thanks, Ruth, and very good points. Meg?
Yes, I appreciate the comments, and I understand where they're coming from. And many Americans did demonstrate that they were willing to make sacrifices. But at the same time, there were also many Americans who were not willing to put up with any kind of inconvenience or pinch in their pocketbook. So at the moment that Carter installs the solar panels, there's a full-on gas riot in Levittown, Pennsylvania, where truckers, who of course drive for their living and felt the rising prices of fuel most acutely, were blockading local gas stations, and all the residents came out actually in support, and they were all chanting more gas as they lit cars on fire, with the expectation that what they wanted was some kind of relief. They did not want to be told to cut back. And so when Jimmy Carter goes on national television amidst the long lines and he says to Americans, you know, the solution has to be cutting back, and we've discovered that piling up more goods doesn't lead to greater happiness, it's not exactly the message that all Americans want to hear at the time.
They never want to hear that, do they?
That's not a popular message.
No.
That's not a popular message. And your caller is also right to emphasize that, as many people did, for example, during the 1991 Gulf War, that if you factor in the cost of that war, that gasoline prices would actually were in fact actually much, much higher than they appeared.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Ruth, for your call. And some of you, many of you probably were alive during these years and can talk about what your memories are. Did you become a conservationist? What do you remember that happened politically? What about price controls? What about our reliance on Middle Eastern oil? Did it come as a surprise to you when we had the first cutoff of supplies in 73, that a lot of our oil was coming from there, the Bush's role in all of this, particularly George Herbert Walker Bush? There's just a lot here. There's a Wisconsin angle I want to explore with our guest, too. Our guest is the author of Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s. Meg Jacobs is our guest. If we could, because there's a Wisconsin tie here, which is interesting and yet another part of the story, which is a complicated story. The Supreme Court decision, I think, of 1956, Phillips Petroleum Company in versus Wisconsin, which had to do with natural gas and whether or not we should be regulating the price of natural gas. What's our place in history here?
Yes, it's a 1954 Supreme Court decision, actually, and it's quite consequential in that it gives the federal government the ability to regulate prices of natural gas at the wellhead. And the fear and the concern in 1954 is that as more people were relying on this new source for electricity in their homes and for heating, any even small incremental increases in price triggered protest. And this led to these court cases. And the result was that government ruled in favor of greater regulation, that Americans had the right to cheap and affordable electricity and energy. And this had an impact, too, on oil prices, because natural gas and oil are often found in the same well. And so the idea is that, and they were also competing sources of energy, so the idea is that price controls on one would hold down the price of the other. And this this reinforced this expectations that Americans really felt that the right to cheap and affordable energy was a birthright.
Mm-hmm. And back to George Bush, because now he's out of oil and he's run for Congress and he's a pretty important guy on the Ways and Means Committee, I believe. Does he have a change of heart when it comes to regulation from the oil business to when he's a member of Congress?
Well, so George Bush is interesting. So he's actually in the oil business in Texas during the 1954 Supreme Court decision. It's one of the things that catalyzes him to become more involved in electoral politics. I mean, of course, he comes from a political family. His father is a senator. But this 54 Supreme Court decision really sort of gave him the momentum to try to organize Republicans in Texas, where they were basically non-existent, and say, you know, it's actually not the Democrats that will support your interests to the other oil producers, but it's the Republicans. It's the party of free enterprise.
Interesting.
And he successfully wins election to office as a congressman in 1966, where he convincingly makes the case that it is Republicans and their deregulatory agenda that would best serve the interest of oil and natural gas producers.
Hmm. Let's go to Michael on the road. Hi, Michael.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the late 70s there when we're talking about the gas crunch, and it didn't seem to affect us much in northern Wisconsin, we worked for a local area, and a lot of us that hung out together, we got to buy our gas for 42 cents a gallon. And I guess the gas crunch must have affected in town. I think gas was maybe 70 or 80 cents a gallon, maybe, but in that 79 era. But for us, the wholesale price we got to buy it for as an employee was basically 42 cents a gallon. And it seemed like there was never, we were never told we couldn't purchase it there. You know, we had to buy it in town. They always seemed to be able to get ample supply of gas to run their business, plus sell it to all the employees. So I remember that era the way you're talking about it, but I don't remember any hardships, I guess, as a teenager growing up, working, but still living at home. So that probably had a little effect in lifestyle, but I guess I didn't really notice the 79 gas crunch, and I don't think any of us really did in the northern Wisconsin area there.
Oh, that's interesting. Is this a rarity, Meg?
Well, one thing that this brings up is that the experiences were, in fact, as your caller suggests, very varied across the country. So there could be lines in some place and not lines in other places. And that mere fact reinforced the idea that somehow the problem was created by Washington bureaucrats with pushpins who did not know how to properly allocate oil, did not know what they were doing, and should just get out of the way. And so these varying experiences reinforce this perception that government was to blame.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Michael, very much for your call. More calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. What was Ronald Reagan saying about all of this in these years when he was governor of California, Meg?
Yeah, so, you know, his response to this was much like what I just articulated. So he is not a fan of government solutions to the problem. He's already a conservative by this point. At the same time, his constituents want their fair share, which he realizes, so he's going to advocate to make sure they get as much of this scarce supply as they can. But from early on, from when he was governor through when he ran against Jimmy Carter in 1980, he's able to use the energy crisis as Exhibit A for why government intervention in markets is a failure. In fact, he's able to use the energy crisis to attack the entire liberal project of the previous generation, going back to the New Deal. And so when he wins office and when he gives his famous inaugural address in which he says government is not the solution to our problems, government is the problem, it's really the experience of the energy crisis that's front and center for him and for many Americans.
Mm-hmm. And what in the meantime has happened to this whole, we've already reached peak production, we have to go to foreign oil. What happened with peak production during this time in this country, Meg?
There was this, it's actually the oil industry that's the first to warn that we're going to be facing an energy crunch, even before the Arab embargo in the fall of 1973, because they explain that it's getting to get ever-increasing amounts of oil to satisfy consumers' demands requires drilling in harsher and more remote locales. And that's an expensive proposition, especially when this is the era of the beginning of all of these environmental regulations, which further increase the cost of oil exploration and production. And so they are saying we are facing a crunch, and if you don't loosen up on all of these regulations, we're gonna run out. And in fact, history bears that out to a certain degree up until fairly recently, where we appeared to reach the peak of our domestic production in 1970.
Mm-hmm. Until we started doing other things, right?
Yeah. So, you know, you have one thing that happens, you do have the discovery of oil in Alaska. There's a big debate, not unlike debates that we've seen today, about the building of a Trans-Alaska pipeline. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of resistance to this. As soon as the embargo happens, the bill flies through Congress, even pushed by some of the same environmentalists who had previously opposed it. So there's this concern, this trigger, the way in which the energy crisis triggers concern over supply. So whether we look to Alaska or we start to import increasing quantities from abroad, there's an increasing push to increase American supply.
Doesn't it astound you, as somebody who's looked at this for so long, so carefully, and written such a wonderful book about this, that we just aren't learning very much? We go through all of these things, and we just haven't figured out, politicians haven't figured out, we haven't demanded that they figure out what the right policy is. It's fraught with problems, and serious problems, every step along the way.
One of the people I write about in the book is an interesting politician, Henry Scoop Jackson, from the senator from the state of Washington. And we often think of Jackson as being this very hawkish foreign policy voice, but he was also a New Deal liberal. And he was a voice that cautioned Americans early on of this growing crunch that we were facing. And he wrote an article, an op-ed in the New York Times before the Arab embargo called The Danger of Doing Nothing. And he said, you know, we're becoming increasingly dependent on oil from this insecure foreign source, and we're running out in our own country, and we need some kind of Manhattan Project or Apollo Project to invest in new kinds of energies for the future. And there was support in the 1970s for public policies to encourage a shift to renewables. And there were some results, but it was not sustained the minute that the energy crisis was over.
Tom is our next caller in Hilbert. Hi, Tom. Tom, are you there? Tom is gone. Mike in Racine. Hi.
Hi. I had my first job. Was pumping gas and starting in 78. So we encountered some northern Wisconsin. We certainly had gas prices. The other gentleman talked about gas prices being cheaper up north. And, you know, I was the one taking money down at the retail gas station, and we were charging as high as $1 to $1.10. I know, because we had to make crazy numbers up to go on the signs, because the signs weren't built to have dollar things on the signs. So I clearly remember that. But I, the important thing is, you know, there were people doing what they could to try to make their ends meet. And I'm sure what that gentleman is thinking of is that there were wholesalers that were selling under the books, but what they were doing is they're selling illegal gas. It was not taxed. So, you know, you weren't paying the tax overhead or the retail overhead that you're required to by law. No, but one thing I wanted to say about just conservation in general is that, as someone who swings left to right depending on what the issue is, I can tell you that, you know, I'm not a big fan of regulation, but on the same token, we have to recognize that we're highly reliant on this commodity that we call gasoline or diesel or energy in general. And the problem is that if we put all of our eggs into one kind of energy basket, you know, don't be surprised when somebody upsets that basket.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think, you know, common sense people really need to step back and say, you know, all the theory on regulation being bad is good. It's good theory. But the reality is there's greedy people. There are greedy countries. There are out-of-line countries. And we need to have the tools in our toolbox through diversifying the energy sources, as well as having the proper regulations in place, so that the people that are being driven more by greed than patriotism or nationalism, if you will, that we have the tools in the toolbox to work with that.
Yeah, point well taken, Meg.
Your caller is exactly right that gas prices, no one could ever imagine a world in which the cost of a gallon of gasoline would be more than a dollar. So there were not enough digits to accommodate that. So the retailers had to price it for the half gallon. So he's exactly right. And what's interesting is to try to figure out why the the gas crisis, both the shortage and the rising prices, did or did not trigger a long-term commitment to conservation. So one of Jimmy Carter's biggest programs that he successfully gets through is he calls for a windfall profits tax. So this speaks to the caller's discussion of greed. There was the perception that energy companies were making such substantial profits at the time that they could, that they were in essence reaping windfall profits, that they could be taxed. Carter pushes for and Congress passes a windfall profits tax on the energy industry. It's kind of stunning. And the idea is to take the proceeds, the revenue generated by that tax, and commit it to creating alternative energies. And Carter sets up a solar bank for energy research, and he also sets up the United States Synthetic Fuels Corporation, which not many people recall, right. But it was this massive public commitment, $88 billion, which was quite a stunning thing at the time, to have government loans support and a sort of public-private venture, the creation of synthetic fuels. Now, what's interesting is that environmentalists hated it because they said this was the wrong kind of bet, the wrong kind of gamble, and they didn't want anything to do with synthetic fuel. They would have preferred to see all the money go into renewables like wind and solar.
Our guest this hour is Meg Jacobs. She is the author of Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis, and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s. Our phone number, we have some emails coming in, too. We'll get to those. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter is at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good evening. Tonight I want to have an unpleasant talk with you about a problem that's unprecedented in our history. With the exception of preventing war, this is the greatest challenge that our country will face during our lifetime. The energy crisis has not yet overwhelmed us, but it will if we do not act quickly. It's a problem that we will not be able to solve in the next few years, and it's likely to get progressively worse through the rest of this century. We must not be selfish or timid if we hope to have a decent world for our children and our grandchildren. We simply must balance our demand for energy with our rapidly shrinking resources. By acting now, we can control our future instead of letting the future control us.
Let's go to James in St. Paul next. Hi, James.
Hi.
Hi.
My question for the guest was, it seemed like both sort of New Deal progressive policies that provided money to keep down prices and conservative free trade economics both led to failures. Neither one was successful in inspiring public conservation. I was wondering if the guest had some comment on which might have failed least or was most successful, if it would have been allowed to run the course in terms of one of the two approaches. It sounds like leadership from both Nixon and Carter were pro-conservation, and yet by the time we get to Reagan, it's solar power's off the White House and free energy. And so I'd just like to get her perspective.
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the number one demand from Democrats, and particularly Northern liberal Democrats, who are still very powerful in the 1970s, so I'm thinking of Tip O'Neill, who will become Speaker of the House, or Ted Kennedy, who will challenge Jimmy Carter in 1980. Their number one demand is that government control the price of gasoline, and they succeed in this. And it's kind of amazing to think about. We often think about the 1970s as this shift towards deregulation, and Carter did deregulate a lot of industries, but energy was the big exception because Democrats, whose constituents were so reliant on oil and for their daily well-being, absolutely did not want to see the prices they paid go up. And as a result, what you had is a sort of contradiction with Carter's appeal to conserve, because here you have Carter saying the solution, the long-term solution, is going to be from cutting back, but then, of course, price controls that keep prices low don't encourage Americans to do precisely that.
Yeah. Dean in Cedarburg writes this, Meg, the 70s turned out to be a good time for bicycle sales. He says, when I heard the crisis was coming, I purchased my first 10-speed bike. I later became a dedicated year-round bicycle commuter. I was living in Milwaukee at the time. My commute was 10 miles each way.
That's impressive. It had to have been cold a lot of that time.
I know.
So, you know, there were efforts to encourage people to ride bicycles. Carter encouraged people to keep their cars parked one day a week. He encouraged people to carpool, this crazy idea for Americans.
Right.
And so there were, you know, efforts to use wood stoves, for example. So there were these sort of local, homegrown efforts to not only conserve, but to be patriotic in the act of conservation. That is, you know, Carter said this will be a true act of patriotism, mm-hmm, if you use mass transit, for example, or share a ride.
Mm. James, thanks for your call. Tom in Cedarburg, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on. If it's okay, I'd like to change a point that I was going to make. In my view, yes, I am for conserving, although I do think it's important that the U.S. not be caught flat-footed the way it was in 73, 74, in that it did not have the production capacity to make up for the loss of the air of oil. I think it's important that the U.S. makes enough oil and enough gas to support its needs, and if it has extra to ship it out of the country the way it does now. What I'd like to see is that the fuel and the oil that's sold here will be kept at a reasonable rate for the U.S. citizens to use and purchase, instead of being able to be on the world market and to, you know, spike it, you know, such high levels the way it was in 2008. And the result of that is a collapse of of much of the economy and the housing market, which we still have not come back from. You know, from $4.30 a gallon. I mean, people are at the point of either they put money in the car to went to work and didn't make their home loans and lost their home.
Yeah, it was way up there, wasn't it, Meg?
Well, it's interesting. We started our conversation by talking about how Americans forget our past. But as your caller brings up, it wasn't very long ago when we were paying more than $4 a gallon for gasoline.
No.
So this is a very rapid turnaround to the collapse of prices. The only other sort of equivalent came in the mid-1980s, 1986, when the global oil market collapsed and prices fell in half then. But it is kind of stunning that within such a short period of time, there's been such a dramatic reversal. And what is stunning about it is the sort of amnesia that we have to forget that.
Why is that, Meg? Why do we have such amnesia about this?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I have the answer to that question. I think if we take the long-term perspective, part of it is that our consumption habits are so deeply ingrained, mm-hmm, into the way we live our lives. So the car, for example, is really central to how Americans experience every day. And that's been true since the 1950s. So for a very long time, whether gas prices are high or low, we are a culture that has the car at the center of it. And that didn't just happen automatically. That also was a result of public policies to create a highway program, mm-hmm, to have a preference for suburban living rather than urban living, to have the GI Bill that helped to finance single-family homes. So our dependence and reliance and preference for this car culture that we have is so deeply ingrained, and that persists whether prices are high or low.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book. It's not only fascinating reminiscing about that decade, but the whole political tie-in, I think, is really fascinating. So thanks for being with
us. Thank you.
Meg Jacobs, the book is Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s. So thanks very much for all of your interesting questions, everybody. KP Whaley, thanks for producing the hour and for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We'll be with you again tomorrow. I think tomorrow we're trying to work out a first-hour program on Hiroshima and whether dropping the bomb was, oh, we're a go. KP says, we're a go. Okay, we're a go. Whether or not it was a necessary decision to end the war. So we will talk about that. Hour one, hour two of our show tomorrow, bullying and how we rid it from our society. So all that's coming up tomorrow. Thank you, everybody, very much for listening.